I want to report on my progress today. I stay pretty busy. I will always probably stay pretty busy. That's in the wiring. And it is my regular experience to have no idea how I'm doing until I'm at a meeting. Because we go slow and read dumb things and there's not a lot happening and I can kind of catch up with myself. And when I bumped into some friends I have here and I've seen before, they said, "How are you doing?" And I had no idea. I had no idea how I was doing. It's been a long day and I got lost getting here because I went on MapQuest and once more they betrayed me. And I got off the freeway and turned left rather than right because that's what they said. And it was, I just saw myself getting just to the side of the Arctic Circle and I turned around and came back. And contrary to my gender, I stopped and asked directions. And there's it's a gas station, 7-Eleven situation on Diablo Road or Diablo Avenue, and it's on the other side of the freeway, and there's a guy there. I just went in and said, "I'm lost, tell the truth, I'm lost," and it was not his fault, so I wasn't angry at him. And I said, "Where's St. Isidore's Catholic Church?" And he said, "It's easy. You go this way and that way." And I followed directions and got here. So I see that as a mental health red letter day, to ask directions and then follow them. And the other is that a few days ago I started the project. I start projects and then put them down. And I finished the project I started 4 days ago, even though it was boring. I finished it. And I was putting something together that was a cabinet that you put things in, and I had 8,000 pieces scattered everywhere, and I actually cleaned up and vacuumed. So I see this as ferocious mental health, and at the moment I'm ready to sponsor the universe because I could tell them that you should ask for directions and vacuum when you're done. I could tell them these crucial things. So anyway, that's how I am. I want to thank you for inviting me out, and I'm glad to be here. And I know some folks, but others of you have probably just heard rumors, and they're all true. I am right on the edge. When the taping folks said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Crazy, but not dangerous." You know? There have been days when I have been crazy and dangerous, but crazy, but not dangerous. I've been coming to Al-Anon for a long time because I have to. I think Al-Anon is a very sophisticated program, and I was in another 12-step program for several years before I realized my need for Al-Anon. I came into Al-Anon through the back door. And I'm real grateful. I didn't come in, Diana said she came into Al-Anon crying and tearful. I didn't come in crying and tearful. I came in very angry and exhausted. And it took me a while to work through some of that. But I was mad because I'm really very helpful. And they take advantage of the helpful over and over and over and over again. And then the only thing you can do for them is kill them. So that's what I know. I come into Al-Anon as an adult child of an alcoholic. In the Al-Anon literature, they'll talk about the various roles we play, and I have played the role of hero a lot. I mean, I'm a teacher by training. I'm a Catholic priest. I mean, hero. And I love social work, and, you know, I could see working in hospital. I mean, I just, when I sense need, especially if they're nuts, there is something deep in my DNA that just starts vibrating a little. And I will hone in on the craziest person in the room and want to pay their rent. That's what I do. And I still want to do that, but I just don't have to do that all the time. But it's taken me a long time. Anyway, I played the role of hero. I have played the role of scapegoat. I have been a jerk. I have acted out. I have caused other people problem. I have blamed others. I have been the one who made other people very nervous. And I have played the lost child where I just disappear. And I've also played the role of mascot a lot, where which I think is a good thing. I really do. I can be very humorous about stuff, but I am only funny about stuff that's life and death, and we all know that, you know. So someone I was having a little difficulty with. Evidently, I'm not the easiest person to get along with, but I was having a little difficulty with someone, and this person says, "Do you know that rather than talk about feelings, you make jokes?" And I said, that was one of the first discussions with one of my first therapists. Who are you? So we didn't return the phone call after that. I mean, I know I do that. That's what I do. You know, then we can talk about feelings later, you know, but my first response is be funny. And I had to learn, and I was new in Al-Anon, and I was working in West Oakland. I've also been a social worker in West Oakland, by the way. That alone would qualify me for 100,000 Al-Anon meetings, but I was working with a group of people, and what I've noticed about people, and this is an observation, not a criticism, we don't get along. We fight, we disagree, we argue. Some of us are prickly and jagged and irritable, and there would be arguments in the office. Now, I've been going to Al-Anon by this time for 2 or 3 or 4 years, which means really very, very early. And I wouldn't notice that I was uncomfortable because people were fighting. I didn't notice that at all. I didn't even notice they were fighting. What happened to me is I got funny. And I would suddenly think of hilarious things to say. And I would say them, and people would laugh. Within about 3 months, everyone hated me. And I couldn't figure out why, because I'm just trying to get along and make everyone perk up and be happy, dancing as fast as I can. And what I was not allowing people to do was have an honest conversation about anything. Because I got anxious, and I'd be funny. So I had to, I talked with my sponsor about this, and you know what they're like. Whiny, cranky people. And what he suggested was the next time I'm at a meeting and something funny occurs to me that I shouldn't say it out loud. Instead, I should just sit with the feeling and see what the second or third or fourth feeling is. And this was very hard. It meant a lot of my Al-Anon program comes down to, Tom, keep your big fat mouth shut. That's a lot of my program. Because I am willing to clarify things for people. I'm one of those. I'm the clarifier. And I kept my big fat mouth shut, and I thought my head would explode. And they would, I'm sure they would prefer hearing the funny insight I had. And instead, I kept my mouth shut, and after the funny feeling went, I started noticing that I had some discomfort because people were arguing. And they get to argue. I had to find out that when two people are arguing, it's none of my business. They get to argue. I have two brothers who are currently arguing. And it is as if all of the air were pumped out of the room. And I'm the youngest. And I have played the role of Henry Kissinger, you know, diplomat. And I was going completely crazy. And it took up my entire head. It took up my entire head. And I was having conversations, fast conversations. With my brothers who weren't in the room, over and over and over again, explaining one to the other, one to the other, one to the other, one to the other. And it has to do with my mom who's having some difficulty, so I got to bring her into the equation, which multiplies everything by 12. And I was frantic because I thought it was my responsibility to sort out all of their stuff with each other and with my mom. And I have a niece who goes to meetings. And she said, "Tom, I don't know about you, but their relationship with their mother is none of my business." I said, "Could you repeat that?" I wrote it down and kept it by my phone. And rather than calling 12 people to bring in the reserves, I haven't done anything. And it's sorted out. It's sorted out. So who knows? Anyway, I'm real glad to be here. As an Al-Anon, it's real important for me to take things day at a time. I love the page for a day. I mean, for a long time, that too was my Al-Anon program. I knew nothing else except ODAP, I believed. Detachment, talking about detachment. My sponsor, who can be pushy, not aggressive, but pushy, he suggested that I always carry a white handkerchief with me. And occasionally, when I am inclined to save others, I should just stand in the middle of the street and wave the white handkerchief, indicating that I have stopped trying to fix, nag, you know, all that stuff. And so I always carry one around. It's one of the few things he suggests that I do. Detachment day at a time. Mind my own business. Mind my own business. Act, don't react. Act, don't react. Act, don't react. How important is it? I was in a complete frenzy years ago. But I remember the good frenzies. One of my friends made some decisions that I thought were stupid, really stupid. Ruining his life! And it took up my whole head. And I was having conversations with him, and of course he was on the East Coast. It makes no difference to me, I will talk with you, whether you're in the room or not. I went to an Al-Anon meeting and I sat down, and the topic was live and let live. And I think I'd been going to meetings for 10 years by that time, and it was as if I had never heard that before in my life. People get to make mistakes. They really do. They get to live. They get, let live. Go ahead, you know. You want to dance naked in the moonlight? I'm very happy for you. You know, go. And I get to live. And I get to live. So, anyway. That's kind of where I come from. I've been going to Al-Anon for about 23 years. I'm of the opinion that most people I know could stand 100,000 Al-Anon meetings just to take the edge off. So, this simply says amends. What about them? Well, let's see. I have found that there have been times I have had to make verbal or financial amends because of my bad behavior. And I think this is real practical stuff. We do an inventory where we look at our stuff. And my defects of character are steady. I used to think that if you said the seven-step prayer right, they all went away. This has not been my experience. My experience is I get a daily reprieve. I get a daily reprieve from the self-pity and the hostility and the meddling and the sarcasm and the ridicule, which is not humor, someone pointed out to me once. I was talking to somebody, and one of the things that I like, the list of do's that were read, I didn't relate to any of those for years. But the don'ts gave me some clarity. Some things I shouldn't do, and I think they're listed here somewhere. Don't be self-righteous. What? How do you not be self-righteous? I want you to know that deep in my wiring is self-righteousness and arrogance. I mean, it's really there. I shared at a meeting, and I guess I looked self-righteous and arrogant, and big surprise. And this person came up and he said, "You're so arrogant." And I said, "Are you identifying or comparing?" I mean, what should I do about it? You know, oh, let's pretend it's not there. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, good idea. So I've got a lot of that. Don't try to dominate, nag, scold, and complain. Well, how else can you communicate? This was such a help to me, and it took me a lot. But I love nagging, scolding, and complaining. And I used to think that was, I taught school for a long time, and I was talking, there was parents that night, and they were talking about kids, you know, and kids can be a little complicated. And so I mentioned that in dealing with a lot of adolescents, I found that it was a good strategy to encourage creativity and curiosity, and I didn't find it helpful to nag, complain, preach, or whine at kids. And one grandmother looked absolutely baffled, and she said, "Well, then how can you talk to them?" I said, "Well, that's the problem. I know when anybody does that with me, I just get instantly hostile. Instantly hostile. It doesn't work with me. But I think it should work with others." Don't lose your temper. Don't try to push anyone but yourself. Don't keep bringing up the past. I taught history. Let me tell you about the past. And in my family, we did this a lot. I have several relatives who, they just don't forget a thing. And they'll bring stuff up. And we have religious difficulties. In my immediate family, we have Lutherans, Methodists, Presbyterians, Masons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Roman Catholics, and Mormons. And most of us get along pretty well. But in every group, there's one or two who really should see a good therapist. And they can get everything confused. So, and we have political difficulties too. The Roosevelt years were hard on some of my relatives, and I had several relatives who would drink and relive the New Deal, and it wasn't pretty. There was a moment somewhere during the Second War, and one of my Swedish Lutheran Republican alcoholic relatives got excited about Mr. Roosevelt, and my father, who was an Irish Catholic Democrat who had a couple of beers, informed him that you do not criticize the President of the United States in wartime. Tell that to an alcoholic, and they get louder and more obnoxious, and their manhood's threatened. So my father threw him out. That was about 1942 or 43. I'm born in 1947. In 1965, there's a gathering of the family for the first time since, you know, that unhappy Mother's Day. And there was a whole group of relatives coming up the walkway that I had never met. And my mother turned to me and said, "Act like nothing happened." Amends. Sometimes making amends is simply saying I'm sorry. Sometimes making amends for me is not necessarily saying anything, but my behavior has changed, and that's making amends. I think the thing with amends is it's so sensitive, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I don't always judge injury well. And so I have to run this by a couple of people with their feet on the ground. I sponsored a guy once who ran out on his family years ago, and he got sober and he decided that as a way of making amends, he had nothing to do with them in about 18 years. As a way of making amends, he just moved back home. And that was our reaction too. We laughed. We thought, oh, that's not good. And we asked real delicate questions like divorce, no, never. Alimony, never. Child support, never. We suggested he just start sending a financial thing. You know, it was time. It was time when he began doing that. Amends are real important. I try to make amends right away. I don't like having these things molder for too long. I owed some financial amends, and it was more money than I had. And my fantasy was to get all of it in the paper bag and bring it over and just hand it to him. Hi, here's everything I owe you. But when was that going to happen? So what I had to do was start paying back something, and I started with a $20 bill. I went over and I said, "This is the down payment. I owe you X amount more, but I've started paying you back. And I'm going to pay you back once a month, X amount." And it got done over a period of time. So I found that useful. Amends. Resentments. I like them. Resentments give me a sense of purpose and focus that nothing else does. And I find when I'm angry enough, I am able to vacuum and take out the trash and throw out magazines that have been in stacks for years. So I try to use that energy. But I get angry a lot. And someone told me I shouldn't, and I said, "Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you." But I do get angry a lot. This is, again, wiring. I don't notice fear very much. That doesn't mean I'm not afraid, but I don't notice it very much. If something scares me, I might have a nanosecond of fear, then I get mad. So sometimes what I'm aware of is how mad I am, and I have to step back a little and breathe a little and let some feelings surface, and it might be because I've gotten scared by something. But the resentment stuff, One description of resentment is anger grown cold. Or resentment is anger with history. There are still some people I resent. I wish I could tell you that my slate is clean here, but I forget about them for a long time until I see them or hear them again, and then a little bit of bile comes up. And what I need to know is my resentments don't hurt them, they hurt me. And I want to ask for help from the higher power in letting go of the resentments for pretty selfish reasons. I don't want to be resentful. And I can be, and I have been. Years ago I heard someone, they didn't know I was listening, but they referred to me as being all piss and vinegar. Which is not a compliment, if you think about it. In fact, I had to think about it for a couple of days. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's not a good thing. But I could bring old wounds up, and when I bring, and I let me confess this to you, I find not just resentment, but I find self-pity and playing the victim delicious. They just can fill up a whole evening for me. And I just feeling sorry for myself. What a good evening. And now, though, I get tired of it a lot quicker. And what I have to do, I usually have to talk about it out loud. I might have to write about it. I'm not a big writer. Some people are, and I'm very happy for them. I'm not a big writer. It's a very useful tool. If you write a lot, I'm use it. I have to be bleeding and on fire to write. And then I write until things are a little better, then I stop writing. But I might have to write the resentment down, and then I might have to share that with somebody. And then I usually have to ask for God's help in letting go of the resentment, because I can't use willpower here. It doesn't work. I really do not understand this as a self-help program. If I could have helped myself, I never would have had to meet you folks. And so I, just nuancing that a little bit, I hear, and again, this is, you can disagree with me on this, it's just fine, and you don't have to tell me you disagree with me on this. You can work it out with your sponsor later, but at some meetings in 12-step world, what I hear is people come up, you know, keep coming back, it works if you work it, so work it, work it, work it, work it, work it. And it sounds like it's Gold's Gym. And it sounds like I'm the one doing it, because I'm working it. Now, I'm all in favor of footwork. And, you know, it's left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. My sponsor says the program throws us the ball, throw the ball back. Participate, say hello to newcomers, sit next to the cranky old timer that no one can stand. I see that as real service. I see that as footwork. Ask God for help. Return phone calls. I see all that as footwork. But if healing begins in my life, it's not because I'm doing it. I don't think the program works if I work it. I think the program works if I let it. And to me, that's a real significant difference. Because most of my misery is self-made. And the program enables me to stay out of the way enough through the footwork. You know, instead of, my problems, talk to the newcomer. You know, listen to the cranky old-timer who has nothing but, you know, still upset about a GSR meeting 18 years ago. Good for you. You hold on to that, you know. But it's asking for God's help with the resentment stuff and the forgiveness stuff, and I can let go of it. And I have noticed this. There have been cases in my life where there was someone who took up an awful lot of space here. And over time, that just wasn't true. And I bumped into this person a year or 5 or 8 years later, and I didn't act badly. I was able to say hello and even, you know, wish them well. Be polite. Be civil. I think polite and civil is real good, by the way. Step three. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand. Let me bring out my white hanky again. This is kind of step three for me. A discussion I've heard a lot with the third step is, do you do it once or do you do it all day long? And the answer is yes. I try to turn things over. I try to let God do whatever God needs to do. I try to stay out of the way. I try to, we in Al-Anon sometimes, at least on the Oakland side, have a little trouble with power and control. And it's really hard not to know best all the time. And there have been times when I have felt no power or control, and panic was the result. Because aren't I supposed to be in charge here? And step three lets me know I'm not the one in charge. I turn things over. I ask for God's help. And then there's that lovely little line about, you know, God as we understand Him. How do we understand God? Not very well. I'll understand God a little differently than you do, and I think that's just fine, and all of us get to find the higher power of our understanding, and mine changes somewhat regularly, and step three. A lot of stuff for me is turning things over, turning things over. I read a French priest, he might be 18th century, and he was talking about step three. I read him in English, by the way. And he said, you know, a lot of us have great difficulty trusting God and turning things over. We have great difficulty turning everything over. And so he said, if you can't turn over everything, just turn over now. And then turn over now. And then turn over now throughout the day. I find for those of us who love alcoholics, this can be terrifying because if I'm not protecting this alcoholic, who is? The alcoholic I love is in jail. Get the governor on the phone. I got a call, and I also want to say this. If I'm emotionally involved with someone, I remember nothing about Al-Anon. Nothing, not one thing. I just get completely stupid. But if I am not emotionally involved, I can give some pretty good Al-Anon conversation, you know. So I got a call from a friend of mine, and this person's in a southern state, and everything's crazy, and one of the kids is in jail for drunk driving again. And evidently in this particular southern state, the jails leave something to be desired. You know, big surprise. And she was so concerned because there were violent drunks of various colors and orientations in the cell. I was able to say, you know, one of those other guys in the cell who might be of a different color and flavor and orientation from your son might be sober. And this might be someone who can get through to your kid because no one else can. Whole new thought. I had to hear this from a Texas Baptist. And they tend to be clear. This is Blanche M. from Austin, Round Rock, Texas. She said, there is one source, and that source is God. There are many channels, and channels change all the time. And what I wanted to do around step three was I wanted to be the only channel for the people that counted for me. And I don't get to make that decision. There's a fellow I just think the world of. I've known him since he was a little kid, and now he's married with two kids, and there's some drinking craziness in the family, and he has it. And I just want to babysit him. He's a teacher, of course, so I want to go with him to class and make sure he doesn't drink during the day, and then drive him home and give him to his wife, and she'll take care of the rest of the evening. And this is crazy. This isn't helpful. I have to leave him in God's good hands. And then we see what happens through him. And I say this about, and this is an Al-Anon thing, I need to remember a lot about the disease of alcoholism. And when someone I love has been sober for a while, you know, 8 days, 8 years, and then relapses, I have to hear it as the disease is back. And I have trained myself to hear, it's the tease, trained myself to hear it as if this person told me I've had another stroke. Or the cancer's back. Or the hypertension's off the chart. Or the diabetes is out of control. I have to hear it as disease. Otherwise, I get angry and want to punish them because I'm convinced they haven't been trying hard enough. Now, I don't do that with anybody who's had a heart attack. I just tell them I'm glad they're alive. And what can we do? So it's important for me to remember that. And so when I get calls from various people who are periodically sober, Al-Anon program here, I always try to be very happy they called. And they're sober today. And I try not to wring my hands or ask 20 questions, because I see that as madness. I once flew from here to there, and I sat next to somebody who counted the number of drinks I was having. That person was sick. How do you find forgiveness? I think we have to ask for it. I read a very useful book. I am a reader. I'm not a writer. I'm a reader. Footnote, I was over at some big fancy thing in San Francisco a few years ago with some writers. They were all writers. I mean, all the Bay Area writers were there. Amy Tan and Annie Lamott and Salman Rushdie was there. It was Herb Cain was there. I met Herb Cain. It was just such a highbrow thing, I almost passed out. And one of the writers, who I've read all of her stuff, she came up and she said, "Oh, are you a writer?" And I said, "No, I'm a reader. You need me." You know, I felt superior to these groveling writers looking for readers. But a book I read that's very useful on this is by a minister of the Dutch Reformed Church, and his name is Smeeds, S-M-E-D-E-S, Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Lewis Smeeds. And he has a book out on forgiveness, and the old title was Forgive and Forget, which is not what the book was about, and it was a lousy title, so I think they've retitled it. But he talks about this process of forgiving. We forgive others and others forgive us. And he does say it's a process, and he does say you can't rush it, and he does think it's a grace. It's not accomplished by willpower or effort. And what I get to do, especially if I loathe somebody, and there are several people who have been on that list, I can ask for God's help. And if I'm not willing to forgive, am I willing to be willing to forgive at some point down the road? Or will I hang on till the last second? I heard a great thing on National Public Radio a couple weeks ago. A new book is out on Franklin Roosevelt. I always perk up because of my own family history on Franklin Roosevelt. And he was very controversial. People loved him. People hated him. And there was this one guy called in to talk about Mr. Roosevelt. And his grandfather hated FDR. And the focus of his grandfather's life was hatred of FDR and the New Deal. And he would just froth and foam. And this lasted, of course, through the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. So that when this guy was a little boy and a young man, his grandfather still in 1965, 1968, 1972 would get frantic about how evil FDR was. Then the old man died. And they're all going to the funeral. And grandma's sitting in the car, and to the family she said out loud, and she had never mentioned this before to anybody, "I voted for Mr. Roosevelt 4 times. She couldn't say it till he was dead, but she did it. You know, so I... I asking for forgiveness. But anyway, Lewis Smead's book I found very helpful. He talked about this whole process, and he talked about it as a process. It's not like I have to forgive them. Sometimes I'm mad for a long time, and I'm not ready to forgive yet. And I get to ask to be ready to be ready. That opens the door a little bit. You know, are you willing to be willing? Do you wanna? Anger. I have never been able to pray anger away. Oh God, remove my anger. That's never worked. Anger for me is a physical energy, and I need to do something physical with the anger. And for me, that usually means working in the yard, digging, chopping, yanking. World Trade Center, you know, happened and woke up and I was numb. My first response to the September stuff last year was numb. And I watched TV all day long. And I watched the towers collapse a lot. And Wednesday I watched all day long. And by Wednesday night I was dangerous. And the numbness was wearing off, just anger. And I've been in Al-Anon for 23 years, so I decided I needed to go outside in the yard and work. And I pulled weeds. I turned on Rush Limbaugh. And little portable radio. Rush is mad every day. And the people who call him are mad. So, I mean, it's really good if you're mad to listen. And some people called and I agreed with them, and some people I didn't agree with them. And I chopped some things up, and I was doing hours of this, and then in the front yard, there was a rose bush that had not been doing well in a couple of years. It was a tree rose, and I had warned it before. But it still wasn't doing well. I yanked it out by its roots with one hand. I felt like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yanked that little guy out. And then I threw him down, and I left him there so the others would see. By that night, I was feeling a lot better. I've also found that swimming helps, walking helps, hitting a punching bag helps, something physical. Baking bread helps. If it's not in the machine, hands. If you're using your scrubbing floors help. All this stuff. I need to do physical stuff, and then so I don't say, "Oh God, never let me get mad." I think if you're not mad, you're not paying attention. That's what I think. So I want to find ways of using the anger that don't hurt anybody, that aren't verbal, because they can be real verbal with me, the sarcasm and the ridicule. But the yard looks pretty good right now. And, you know, there's a lot of weeds out there. I've been pretty content. Let me do one more, and then we can all go home. Well, here's another amends one. Oh, we did that. And this one says, walk through the steps next time. Self-love, I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, I know that it's heresy to say that in California, you know, but I have no idea. I think most of the time I think I'm doing pretty well. And I'm also pretty aware of the fact that I need 100,000 meetings. And there are women and men in the program who love me, and I take their word for it. This was a big deal. I knew there were two points of view about Tom. One was that I was an embarrassment and disgusting, and that was my point of view. And I bumped into people who thought I was good to have coffee with. They'd call me, let's hang out. And as a recovering decision, I had to decide which one I chose to believe. And I chose to believe the people in the rooms. That was a decision. And sometimes I don't like me very much. Comes and goes. And when I'm very punishing and full of self-criticism and that voice is going, I know it's madness and it means I need some meetings and I need to be around people who treat me better than I treat me. And that's how I handle that. And I ask for God's help. And I think a lot of the stuff in the program, it's learning how to be useful and how to live with people. And if I am totally embarrassed with who I am and how I'm wired, I'm not going to want to share that with anybody. But if I have some appreciation for me, a work in progress, I'm willing to share that with some people. And sponsorship, this will be the last thing. Because I think it's 9 o'clock. Don't you all go home at 9? Isn't that... I have a sponsor. I think sponsorship is a very good idea. There are many different ways people sponsor. Some people do it with a lot of structure, and others don't. You got to find what works for you. The best thing I do for the people I sponsor is I'm gone a lot. And it means they have to talk to other people. I think that's really good. And this is an Al-Anon thing, when I'm in my right mind, I don't give people a lot of advice. I can tell them what I've done, but I don't tell them what they should do. Most of the time, there are some exceptions. There was someone, they had a lot of kids, and dad was a little erratic, one might say. And when I heard about all of the guns in the house, I strongly suggested that the guns be gotten rid of. But I don't give a lot of other advice. I don't have kids. I taught kids. That's not the same thing. And I sponsor a couple of young men who have young families, and they'll ask me for advice. So I go, I encourage them to talk to other men in recovery who have small children. Because that's, you have to talk to your peer group. My sponsor, he lives in L.A. I talk to him regularly. I don't frequently ask him for advice. Sometimes I do. Sometimes what I need is some feedback. Because I'm in a situation and I don't know what my options are. And I can tell him the situation and he can help me see what the options are. And he's only forbidden me to do two things, he tells me. I can only remember one, which shows you the resistance I have. But he swears there's two. I don't know what the other one could be. Once I ran something by him once and he said, oh, that'll kill you. Keep me posted. That's what he said. And I learn through trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. That's how I learn. And people I sponsor, it's trial and error, trial and error. And I think that's a good thing. My sponsor is clearly crazier than I am, and it's such a relief. Because I think I'm having a bad day, and then I talk to him, and, you know, oh, piece of cake. So if you're looking for a sponsor, I suggest you find someone who's crazier than you are. You know? You'll always feel better after talking to them. And when I sponsor other people, I heard this in priest school, and it's one of the best things I ever heard. When you're in a situation with somebody and it's delicate, and this is for the sponsor, pray for the grace to know when you're in over your head. Because some stuff I can't handle. I don't know how to do it. So it's okay to refer people. And I've told some people it's time for therapy. You know, I've told some people it's time to find the doctor with the medication. I've told some people I think you might need professional care. Because stuff was way out of control. And they needed more than meetings. Some people stayed with me and some people went on to someone else. That's just fine. Have I ever fired a sponsee? No, I think that's just too dramatic. I just usually piss them off and they stop calling. So, I sponsor one guy over the last 15 years, and every so often I make him so mad he won't talk to me for 5 years. Then he'll call. I say, hi. And I don't go, where have you been? I just, glad you're alive. It's okay to talk to someone else. I don't see that as disloyal, you know. But I evidently sound like his father every so often, and I'd stop talking to me too if that was the case. Oh, well. I think I'm done. Thanks for tonight, and congratulations on your year.